I don't know if I stole your thunder there, but
no, that's good, man. Like, there's enough thunder to go around. It's a hell of a story. So, like, there's a lot of things I can make, just, you know, dumb sex jokes, and you could be here being the smart guy.
I would listen to that podcast, John.
Hey folks, welcome back to our podcast. I'm John Meehan, and this is Everything That Rises, a podcast about the short stories of the one and only, the inimitable, the incredible Miss Flannery O'Connor. I feel like I'm overselling it. But talking about it this week, I wanted to bring in somebody who can help me figure out whether I'm overselling it or just believing my own hype. I love her short stories. I think she's fantastic. As an English teacher, as a writer, as an author, as a speaker, as a presenter, like, I geek out over things that are well made in this genre. And so to do this hard work of taking it apart, I bring in smart people to help me do it. Do you want to introduce yourself and say hi for this week's guest?
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, everybody. I'm John Spike, coordinator of instructional technology integration services at University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Basically help pre-service teachers use technology in their future teaching. For that, I was a tech integrator. And before that, I was a high school English teacher, and I had the privilege of teaching Flannery O'Connor during my student teaching. And I'm so thrilled, John called me up to the big leagues to talk nerdy about this story, a stroke of good fortune.
Oh, yeah.
I am.
The big leagues of a podcast where two people sit around, and I think my audience right now, it might be my mom. God bless her. Hi, mom, if you're listening. You can be on a podcast too. Yeah, this is great. We can talk about my mom's an educator as well. So it's not just for educators. It's not just for people who are of Flannery O'Connor's tradition in the South. You mentioned, John, you're from a far way from Milledgeville, Georgia. Yeah.
yeah. Just a bit. But I can definitely relate to the small town Pittman aspect of this story.
Got it. And this week, so every week we take a new story, and we take it about 45 minutes for the first half, about 45 minutes for the second half. We split it over the course of 2 weeks because it's just a lot to digest. And so if you're a new listener, if you like what you're hearing, go back to the archives. There are plenty of old episodes. And we'll be back next week with a new story. New story every 2 weeks, and we just break it up into pieces and parts. But we talked last week about, like, the first half of this story, and we started to set the stage for this is the short story called A Stroke of Good Fortune. John, you picked it. Can you help us kind of, like, previously on...
Yes, absolutely. So previously in A Stroke of Good Fortune, we kind of got introduced to Ruby, who is our main character, our protagonist. And she is a 34-year-old woman. She is getting ready to ascend the stairs of her apartment complex. We know that she's got a younger brother, Rufus, who she's not entirely proud of, who he is and the fact that he's still attached to Pittman. She's got Bill Hill, her husband, who she definitely thinks she married into someone who saved her from this small town life and is a good man.
Yeah.
And she's been reflecting back on how her mother and her sisters, have clearly, wasted their life and aged, quite a bit from having children. And those children have almost sucked the life out of them, so to speak. And so she's also kind of having some strange things. She's getting tired. She's experiencing some pains that she's not quite sure what they are. And we just had Mr. Jerger tell her about Ponce de Leon's birthday and how he tried to find the fountain of youth. And it's fitting because Ruby seems a bit fixated on her age, her age 34.
Age.
That isn't really anything,
Right.
And she's comparing herself to where others have been at that age. So I think that catches
us. Yeah, it does. I like it this time. You refrain from picking on those of us who are close to 40 or on either side of it. So just for whatever that's worth. So our heroine, our protagonist, Miss Ruby, is finding her way up this arduous trek of steps, one after another. And like a good hero's journey, she has a chance to encounter, the wise old man along the way, maybe the child, the innocent. And now it's the girlfriend, I don't know, whatever it is, like the lady, maybe the little bit more worldly lady who's in the mix here. But as an English teacher, I gotta say, I would be remiss if I did not read into every last stupid thing. the woman's name happens to be Laverne Watts. And for me, and this is just me, if your last name is Watts, I'm thinking light bulbs, I'm thinking electricity, I'm thinking illumination. And these are people along her journey who are more illuminated than Ruby is. Mr. Jurger has a single light bulb dangling above his head as he's in his space. Miss Watts is called Miss Watts, and she knows just by looking at Ruby that something is up. But meanwhile, our heroine has been making for illuminations, for predictions, for like, you know, prognostications of where the future goes. She's been making regular trips to like this gypsy woman who is a projector. And I should point out, like, that word gypsy by modern standards is racially charged, right?
Yes.
I'm using it because Springsteen himself, Bruce Springsteen, cites Flannery O'Connor as a major influence through his writing about these nuanced characters. The entire Springsteen album, The River, is all influenced by these deep, he says that Flannery O'Connor has like a truth about her characters. They're like, they're gritty and they're raw and they're real. But he'll use the word gypsy in that. He talks about like the gypsy woman lies, or like the gypsy fortune tellers, because it's this othered version of like an alternate religion that's just totally divergent from the Judeo-Christian tradition. And it's not entirely true that that's the way it is. So like, again, just a modern context of how that word comes up here. But we have Madame Zolita, who has been given like fortune telling predictions for this woman, Ruby, who is hoping for a stroke of good fortune. Is that about where we are?
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting too. You taught your discussion about Madame Zolita. You know, the one thing that probably everybody who was taught Flannery O'Connor in school remembers is probably the grotesque character. And this story, I would say, doesn't have the standard definition of it, but it does have ones who are kind of the othered in maybe that Catholicism viewpoint. And maybe Madame Zolita is the closest thing we have in that she is, again, presenting this alternative worldview, like you said, that's based on maybe more of what Catholicism would call a shallow backing of its, you know, its prognostication, for lack of a better words. But yeah, this story really doesn't have maybe that quote unquote grotesque per se, but she might be kind of Flannery's way of you know, sizing up someone against that belief.
Like a lampshade of that. And I think that might be it too. Like Mr. Jurger is described as if he's an old man with what appears to be mildew on his face because he has a goat-like beard. So he's a little askew, right?
Yeah.
You know, like Laverne Watts is described as a tall, straw-haired girl who makes a great guffaw. So maybe a little bit more like, cash me outside, how about that, right? Like there's something about this character who's maybe more sexually awakened. It seems like she gets there very quickly. But I'm interested too, because I think that there is maybe a light judgment that's being cast on, you can do the Jesus stuff or you can do the not Jesus stuff. And I think that that's a recurring theme in O'Connor. These characters who we're encountering are all a bit odd or a bit, you know, like a funhouse mirror version of themselves, I guess, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. I would agree.
So we find ourselves in this now second landing. The first landing, we saw Mr. Jurger. He tried to make conversation. Our hero wasn't having it, so up she went. And she got up there gasping and feeling as if her knees were full of fizz, knocks on Laverne's door with the butt of this boy downstairs. His name is Hartley Gilfeet. He had a small pop gun, like a tin gun downstairs. And as she opens the door, there's Laverne, tall and straw-haired. That gun! She staggers back and sort of laughs at Ruby as she falls into her house. I'm interested to hear your thoughts about this, because this is like a major pivotal scene. And in fact, like, it's a very short story. So really, we spend most of this story in the house of this woman who's just a neighbor. And we're revealing a lot about things that happened both before and after during this scene where really not much happens.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you getting at what is transpires next, or like the lead up to that moment? Just want to,
you tell me, man, like we can talk about all of it because it's here.
Yeah. I harped on this in the first, you're probably sick of hearing it, but I just love Flannery O'Connor's names and Hartley too. I don't know if we talked about Hartley, but she's just like banging us over the head with like, Mr. Jurger talks about he had to find the fountain of youth in his heart. She's mm-hmm. worried about heart problems. Hartley Gilfeet's, you know, pistol, she sits on it and we'll encounter him again. And she's kind of hitting us over this heart, you know, motif as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to make sure we talked about, we just addressed that before it got away from us. But she, again, Flannery O'Connor never wastes anything. I feel like sometimes in stories, names are wasted. But again, you pointed out Laverne Watts isn't even wasted because we've got another opportunity for enlightenment here. One thing that's interesting in this scene is how Ruby tries to almost dismiss, I think, Laverne, and she tries to play the marriage card. Again, we kind of circle back to the Catholicism, like, well, why should you be passing judgment on what you think you know about me? I'm married, you're not. And like almost that, right. Again, she's using that yardstick measurement of, I have checked these boxes. I haven't fallen into these pitfalls that other, you know, like you said, lower class people just have children without even thinking twice about it. And so again, she tries to keep up her denial act by using her own defined kind of, rules about what makes somebody a hill versus a pit. Right. Thing that happens in here is she tries to denounce Laverne with whatever she can. One of the weapons she uses is marriage in this scene.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Like she's marriage shaming her. It's interesting. She kind of does that thing. So like Laverne, without 4 seconds of it, and we have to talk about, again, awkward, dirty jokes written by genteel Southern ladies. So as she comes in, she falls down, she has this gun, and she's like, where'd you get that gun from? And she says, oh, I sat on it. Oh, Lord. Like, if my kid was to make that joke in class, I'd be like, Bobby, you're going to have a moment after class. You can't be saying you're sitting on each other's guns. You can't be saying that.
Right, like, right.
that here is, for the reader who's hip, clearly an in-joke on, are you getting it yet? Because there's a lot of that going on here. And while I think that, like, that's crazy, and maybe that's what an English teacher reads too far into it, we also have the benefit of having read the story more than once. It's not outside of the realm of what this story is about to be making sex jokes from this character's mouth, because that's exactly what she's doing. When she stands there, at her stomach, she folds her arms and points her stomach out, swaying back and forth. So, where'd you get that gun from? Just swaying back and forth with her stomach stuck out, a very wise expression growing on her face. Her ankles are swollen. Oh, look at them swollen. You know, I mean, I'm not a doctor, but doesn't even say, like, hey, it's good to see you. Do you want a glass of water? She's like, you look a little thick today. And she says she murmurs and giggles. Is that, I mean, like, I don't know. And I guess maybe I have a lot of thoughts. I have a lot of questions. As a teacher, what is the appropriate amount of conversation to have here, both with students and like with the text? Because it's there in the text, right? You don't pick things to be salacious to sort of like try to sensationalize or scandalize your kids. But that women's intuition, like a mother just knows kind of thing, is happening in play here. And I think what O'Connor is pointing out is there's a very worldly woman who is able to identify whether she's married or not. No, I know what this is, man, and that there's no way around it.
Well, that's the beautiful thing is O'Connor challenges you to try to, you know, make your own judgment calls about these characters. And she has, you know, on the one hand, she has Ruby, who refuses to come out and say it. She just, as you've mentioned, we were careful. We were so careful. You know, like, I'd have 5 kids if we weren't as careful as we were. She keeps dancing around the S word. And then you've got Laverne, who's like nudging you, you know, with her elbow. Right. And then you've got Flannery O'Connor dropping these little hints. So, you know, we talk about when we do Romeo and Juliet, you know, in ninth grade, I don't run away from the innuendo in Act 1, Scene 1, because it's there and the students are wondering it. And instead of just blowing by it and pretending like this isn't a thing that happens, I do address it. Sometimes we were lucky. We had a Shakespearean actor come in and really deep dive into that scene and made it so I didn't always have to, you know, explain the jokes.
Helpful.
Yes. Helpful. Yeah. Like, it helps me dodge.
You know, maidenheads are taking people up against walls. Right.
Helpful. Thank you. Thank you, John, for saying it so I didn't have to. I appreciate that.
I got you, buddy.
You're a hero.
I got you, friend.
But, you know, Flannery O'Connor does, it's fun just watching her because she's like, you know, this character, I've shown you enough of her to know that she's never going to come out and play with these terms, but I'm going to give you characters who are going to try to goad them. And I think it's a little bit because Flannery O'Connor was that person. She liked to kind of goad and cross the line. And so she inserts characters who do that to others. And I think that's what this scene is about, is Laverne just being that antagonist to get her to realize it. And she does it. And Laverne is just a fantastic character of just being entertaining in the way she goes.
I agree. So I have a lot of thoughts. First is that you said the word inserts, and I'm like, boobs and butthead. He said inserts. The second is like, I'm an idiot. The second is the office, like the that's what she said joke, right? It's like you're leaving it open so that it's the thing that somebody's going to send it home with. And I think also when I teach Shakespeare to my students, like in working with Romeo and Juliet, I was like, all right, guys, yeah, I mean, there's some stuff here. And it's kind of like it's like teenagers making teenager jokes, you know, like sex jokes, 16-year-olds trying to pick on each other. About, like they're, you know, who's the most manly, who can get the most girls, whatever it is like that. So like, keep your eyes out if you see any. Every time a kid's like, wait, he says, what ho? Is that one of them? I'm like, no, what ho is not. Who's there, ho? I'm like, no, not that, guys. Let's move on. But I think in this moment, this very salt of the earth type character, Laverne, who like is even in just a few strokes of the pen, a very sexually aware person. And then immediately she's painted as, you know, maybe a little bit less classy than the traditional Southern woman might be. Like she doesn't stand on ceremony. so she thinks about, oh, she asks Ruby, oh, Rufus is home from combat? I thought I'd ask him how he liked my shoes. Like she's in the era before right swiping and left swiping. She's looking to like meet people and meet guys. And it feels like that's on brand for this woman here, which is interesting too, because now I'm thinking about, this is weird for two men to talk about on a podcast, but like this sexual awakening for these female characters, because in some ways O'Connor is saying, look, sex is part of life, right? That's how we all get here. And that Rufus is treated as but a baby, end quote from Laverne.
Yes.
Like, babies and sex, like, is sex a recreation thing or is sex a procreation thing? Because all of these things are happening here at once.
Yeah, and it's just a really clever idea to really bring Rufus back in this moment, because it also... it says a lot about how she views him. He came back from the European theater. We know he fought in a war, and she is dismissing him as a child still. And it shows just how much she is like her clock about like 30, she has these things about what 34 should be and what 20 is, you know, Rufus is 20. And I believe Laverne is 30, and she just thinks like, this is an adult trying to target my baby brother. And it further shows that, but yeah, you're right. She's also playing a little bit with this conversation we're having. She switches gears and tries to make it about like Rufus is a, you know, he's in play for me. Like that is somebody like it wouldn't be out of the question if he and I became a thing. And just Laverne bringing that up has put that back on Ruby. And she makes, I think Laverne makes a great joke about like when she calls him a baby, like there, well, there's going to be two of them then pretty quick here if he's a baby.
Yeah.
And just a great line, to just really hammer it home for her, to ruin it. I don't know if I stole your thunder there, but,
no, that's good, man. Like there's enough thunder to go around. It's a hell of a story. So like, there's a lot of things I can make just, you know, dumb sex jokes. And you could be here being the smart guy.
I would listen to that podcast, John.
Boom. It's called Dumb Sex Jokes. And John is smart, but you're the John who gets to be the smart guy. I'm just going to, you know, the other one. No, there's like this thing. So we're talking about sex and talking about babies. This is the most family friendly sex podcast you could have.
Yeah.
Ruby mutters and sees again, with plenty of time. She mentions that her brother, quote, out nowhere before he was born. She repeats that line three times, through the story, that like her kid brother, she has not much use for. And again and again and again, she repeats, yeah, he's just like, I don't know. He's there, but not there, out nowhere before he was born. I'm interested as a fellow teacher of English, or I don't know, just someone who's, again, John gets to be smart and I get to be the guy with the jokes. What does that mean, out nowhere before he was born? Because she says it three times.
Yeah, it's tough because I believe the last time is like that final moment in the short story. So I don't want to comment too close on that because again, I really feel like O'Connor absolutely like leaves you breathless with some of her final moments. But you know, it's really interesting because yeah, if you look at the full context of that quote, it's one of the ones, you know, I highlighted and I've got in my important quotes, like, so I'm waiting out nowhere before he was born, just waiting to make his mother only 34 into an old woman. And it's interesting just saying like Rufus is just waiting in this void and his only sole purpose is he's just waiting for his moment to drag down, you know, this female character. And you know, that's just like a, it's, you know, she brings it up too about like potential child, like not having something just waiting out there and nowhere waiting to make her debtor too. So it always seems tied to like, you know, this, you know, the, these people on this islands in this voids who are just waiting to suck the life or drain others. I don't know what to make out of the nowhere in the void. I'm kind of interested.
So it's very nihilist and I'm fascinated. So I teach a lot of Southern Gothic literature and I love the stories of William Faulkner. I'm now, you can hear it. Ooh, ah, you hear the soft cover.
Yes.
I'm opening my copy of As I Lay Dying. And in it, if you have not read it, there's a woman named Addie Bundren who is dying, major spoiler. And so her family has to take an odyssey of a burial trip. They kind of carry her rotting body in the family wagon. They're very poor. They're like a very, very poor, white trash. They're described in the book. And they have to bury it, up in Jackson or your Jefferson, County. So it's like a multi-day ride, but along the way there's a cyclone, there's a fire, there's a river that floods. So it's like, it's the family road trip from hell. And along the way, like the Kurosawa film Rashomon, you get different characters' versions of what was happening. So every different character tells his or her version of the story with a rotating narrator. But about midway through the book, as they're in the second trial, they're passing through this flooded river, you actually hear from Addie, the flashback, the mom who has died. We feel bad for her. Oh my God, her body's been desecrated through this whole thing. But she says in this chapter, which I'm just like, it's brutal. She mentions that she says her father said to her when she was a girl, that the reason for living was to get ready to stay dead for a long time. And then she said, I would hate my father for ever having planted me. And so she says, so I never loved anybody. I married this guy named Ants. I don't really care about him. I had kids with him. But she says, I felt violated and violated over and over each day because my aloneness has been violated. And she says, he had a word, love, he called it. But he had used words for a long time. I knew that word was just like any other word, just a shape to fill a lack. It's like ants or love, love or ants, it didn't matter. She's a straight nihilist who hates children, who hates family. And I'm like, wow, there's so much here about, talk about Southern Gothic literature, the idea of mothers who hate the idea of being mothers because they feel that their womanhood is being stripped of them and they're being reduced to this dried up husk like the town of Pitfield, a pitman, like to just be, you have to be a vessel and it sucks the life out of you. But that's not just one author who's doing it. That's like almost like a convention of Southern Gothic literature. And that to me says, well, we need to talk about that, right?
Yeah, I think that's a great reading into this. Is it really does, if you take a step back and look at the genre, you know, that is something that's prevalent. And it's interesting too. Flannery O'Connor never was a mother, you know, for a variety of reasons. And like how it's interesting to see how she uses this Ruby character and the act of motherhood and the reflections. And you wonder if there's any bit of Flannery in this, or if she is just more trying to point out the hypocrisy here, or if it's both, you know.
When you say hypocrisy, let me push that a little further because I'm interested to hear your read on that. I think there's fruit on that tree.
Yeah, I mean, I think you brought it up in the first part, you know, Catholicism, and this is my like ignorance here. You know, I very much observed it again in my Pittman-esque hometown of like be fruitful and multiply, and you know that attitude of just, you know, let it happen. And yet at the same time, we've got this character who is very much feeling like that attitude is creating the downfall of life, right? That's creating the downfall of these characters. And so subscribing to that is problematic, you know? And so I think there's a tension here of, you know, her coming to grips with, is this the life for me, the life that my mom lived, or even some semblance of that life coming true. And I think there's some hypocrisy in that Catholicism mindset with, you know, somebody trying to come to terms with what they want their life to be. And you mentioned it too, the, you know, in that story, you know, being bitter about motherhood and what it took from who you wanted to be.
Yeah. And I think that's, I mean, I have a lot of thoughts. So like As I Lay Dying is tipping into the idea of the Southern Gothic, like the South is a patriarchy with like this genteel sort of gentry who has like this new aristocracy who is trying to make a tradition off of the hired hands, like the laborers and the people who are descendants or like the direct relatives of slaves. So the idea of the liberated woman comes up in the 19-teens, 1920s, like what does it mean to be first wave feminist? What does it mean to be second wave feminist? And I think that O'Connor is grappling with that very clearly.
Yeah.
Now, she doesn't fall maybe where many contemporary third wave feminists or postmodern feminists would fall. But she's talking about, like, I mean, reproductive rights issues, you know, sex issues. But she's also doing it through the lens of a character who comes from a town of Pittman, who just so happens, what do you know, in the next line, to drop the N-bomb because, well, you know, an N-woman up the road told me it was what a boil on my foot. I'm fine. It all went away. Like, I feel like she's simultaneously pointing that the old generation is, like, racist and wrong and like, subjugating people. But the new generation thinks they're so smart. They think they've got it all figured out. They have their little science. They have their little plans. They have their little, you know, contraceptives. And, like, that causes these pure characters, these outsiders, like Mr. Jerger from downstairs, to be like, nobody thinks anymore. No one thinks. No one. And that includes you, lady. Like, it's that line in A Good Man is Hard to Find where Red Sammy Butts tells the grandmother, you know, yeah, a good man is hard to find. They get harder and harder every day to find these good people. And it's like, if we are in the 2020s saying, oh yeah, the world is all messed up. Like, they were saying that in the 1950s. They were saying that in the 1880s. Like, that's not a new conceit.
Yeah. That's what also drew me to the story is if you took away like Brother Comes Back from European theater, this is a pretty timeless story. Like, this could happen, you know, somebody could go up the stairs and be grappling with, you know, their place, as you said, like their role to carve out their own path or, you know, just continue the bloodline or what have you. And Flannery O'Connor's story is the reason they've endured this long is because, yeah, there's some time sensitive topics that she's really tackling of the time, but at the same time, her characters are still wrapping their heads around things we haven't resolved fully, time period.
Offline, you were talking about Achiever story that you kind of were reminded of or recalling when we're talking about this idea of going on a journey, coming back from a journey and seeing parts or flashes of your life vignettes of that. I'm interested to maybe talk some about that.
Yeah, as soon as I read this story and I realized, I know some people, if you told them, okay, this is a story literally about a woman going up a flight of stairs and bumping into some of the neighbor people, they'd ask, okay, well, but what happens, right? And in the Cheever, John Cheever writes a very, very famous short story, The Swimmer. Also got to teach that like right after, you know, the Flannery O'Connor shorts. It was just a great semester.
Awesome.
Anyhow, that's in that story, this gentleman, he's in a, you know, wealthy upper class neighborhood and they all have swimming pools. And he decides he's going to go on a great odyssey and he's going to travel home from one of the swimming pool parties all the way through the backyards of swimming pools back to his house. He's going to go on this grand adventure. He names the swimming pools, the river after, I think it's like Lucinda or Lucille after his wife or something like that.
Okay.
And he, through the story starts traversing through these pools and to get back to his home at the end of the day. But as he's going through, you're getting the sense that as he's traversing, people are becoming more and more bitter towards him in each pool. And you're finding out little snippets of his life and what's happened and interacted between these people. People start asking him like, oh, is everything okay after the trouble? And suddenly you're seeing like, not only is how people are treating him different in terms of like, they're starting to change him, treat him differently, but you're seeing, it's almost as if the seasons seem to be changing and things have transpired on his epic journey that's supposed to just take place in an afternoon, and he gets home and everything has changed, you know, to not take too much away. He gets home and things are drastically different. And in this story, you feel like, oh, I just witnessed a day. How did so much go wrong in this amount of time? And I feel like a little bit of that is happening in this story. We've got this stairwell, and yes, literally in this story, she will traverse up the stairwell and that's all that literally happens. But I would argue that maybe this story isn't bound by either the time constraints or the running metaphor that's going through is looking at a wider swath. And I love that. I love the approach of here's this confined space, but this space is acting more as a vehicle for something bigger to the story. And that's what happens in The Swimmer. And I think that's what O'Connor does really nicely in this story.
This is expertly said, and that so a great second read, right? If you're inspired by the short fiction of Flannery O'Connor, short fiction, The Cheever, amazing recommendations. I feel like I should do a whole podcast of just like related reads to Flannery O'Connor. If you like this, you'll love that. I mentioned like Faulkner's As I Lay Dying. I mentioned like they're all cut from the same cloth, which is like these existential journeys. In these, and you mentioned it in our first podcast for those who were not remembering last week's podcast, but you said like the first lines of her stories are almost so forgettable and like pedestrian. And they build to this big climax of that last line is, oh my goodness, what is this? Like, there's something big and revealed, because it takes a very simple thing that we can all identify with and says, and again, this is a very Catholic reading of it, very Christian reading of it, but like, in these everyday mundane moments, there is opportunity for salvation. There is opportunity for reflection. There's opportunity for grace. And it's funny because she's presented with characters who have light imagery or like advice imagery around her. And she ignores the ones who maybe have her best interests at heart in favor of talking to the person who she wants to get information from, because she knows the type of answer she's going to get from that lady. And that's what she's seeking out. And that to me is fascinating. Yeah. I also like the idea of the prophecy that she was told was, after a long illness, she will experience a stroke of good fortune. And here we are, because now Laverne calls it out. She's like, two or three big dances in a step. She's like, and if you put these letters together, you know they spell? M-O-T-H-E-R, mother, mother, and stretches her arms out. And then Ruby's like so mad she could smack her. But she, no, not me. Bill Hill takes care of that. Bill Hill takes care of that. Bill Hill's been taking care of that for 5 years. Like, I ain't going to happen to me. Like, just because you said it three times doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Yeah, not like Beetlejuice.
Don't say it. Don't say it twice.
Yeah.
I would tell my students in a book, you know, if a character repeats themselves, and I think this is true in life too, they're either trying to convince you of something, or more likely, they're trying to convince themselves of something. Like your mom say, hey, how you doing? You're like, I'm fine. I'm fine. Like, that second fine means you're not fine, man. And she says three times, no, Bill Hill takes care of that. He takes care of that. She's like, well, old Bill Hill just slipped up 4 or 5 months ago, my friend, Laverne said, just slipped up. This is an awkward thing, but we kind of have to talk about it. As a writer, I'm interested because Flannery O'Connor is female, and she's written two female characters having a female conversation. But as a reader, my spidey sense is saying, I know not everyone's cycles are regular, but this is an eyebrow raise moment that there should be some signs or some non-signs that this woman could kind of be hip to that. And if that's such a blind spot to her, or maybe she's just been so preoccupied, she hasn't even thought.
Yeah. I think that's a great question. I hadn't thought about that, yeah, there's definitely, you know, I'm not a doctor myself, but I know there are signs if she says 4 or 5 months ago was her estimation. Seems like Laverne, as you said, is worldly and seems to know what she's talking about. I do think maybe part of it is that she has truly slipped into this denial phase, and she is, as you mentioned, we do those things where we don't get it checked out and we don't address it because we don't want to face the truth. And I feel like that's the only real explanation I can come up with, is she is trying to explain it away with other things. You know, she is trying to justify why, you know, some of those regular processes aren't occurring.
The closest thing I have to that is, when was the last time I put oil in my car? And like, I don't think about that. I was told every 3,000 miles I'm supposed to. But if I was to ask you, like, on the spot, when was the last time you took your car in for like an oil change? You'd really have to think about it. You're supposed to do it every 3,000 miles. There should be a natural cycle to that too. But like, when your car's making noise, I'm just not going to take it in, because you don't, like, the closest thing I can do here, again, to be as sensitive and as tactful as I can, this woman says she doesn't go to the doctor because she doesn't want to hear what the doctor has to say. She can take care of herself. She can fix herself. Like, I think about that because in the last podcast we talked about, like, if your car is breaking down, you're hearing noises, you just turn the volume up so you don't have to deal with that reality. It's like going to a doctor is going to give her news that she doesn't want. Going to a mechanic is going to tell me something I don't want to hear. I think that that's a very human thing too, to just do whatever you can to avoid hearing that which you kind of already know to be true.
And what's also fascinating is she said if she went into the doctor, she'd be happy if they told her something's wrong with her heart, because they can't take her heart out. She said that rather than, oh, well, if they told me I was pregnant, it'd be fine. She'd rather have them say you have something wrong with her heart. And I don't know if that's just her, like, trying to talk her way out of it, justify the inaction that she's doing. But just even the way she's talking about this, she's going in these other directions, like heart problems and cancer at one point, rather than really try to go down the route that really adds up to the symptoms she's showing.
Yeah. And like, if again, like, she's saying, hey, I'm throwing up, my ankles are swollen, I'm having a hard time climbing upstairs, I'm noticing I'm putting on a little bit of weight. And oh my God, oh my God. And then Bill Hill. Now to the next page, talks about he would never slip up. He would never slip up. He would never do that. I mean, the skirt is getting a little tighter, but no, he would never slip up. You know, I don't know. And like, again, without putting anybody's stuff on blast, I think this is a very human moment where if anybody has ever been in a situation where there's a pregnancy or a pregnancy scare or an unexpected pregnancy, these are the things that you're doing when you're waiting for that stick to turn a different color. Like, where was I? How was I? How can this be? Like, she's running through all of this stuff, almost as if you can convince yourself, regardless of what the science is about to tell you, like, you can just make it true by doing it a different thought process. But we come to find out, you know, that little feeling, that little piece, she says that piece of her felt like it was rolling over inside of her. Nothing's supposed to roll over. Like, you know, and so Madame Zolita, she thinks about it again, would end in good fortune. She said it would be crying and saying, you know, just one step and I did it. One step and it did it. I'm interested in that quote too. One step and it did it. Talking about one slip up, and that's the difference between pregnant and not pregnant. She says one step and it did it as she's crying, making her way up the stairs.
Yeah.
I don't think that's an accident.
Yeah, just again talking about the journey and the fact that it's contextualized in these, you know, these rearing up steps that she's going on. Of course, you know, just lines up. I think nicely with the metaphor that that Flannery O'Connor's been setting up this whole time for sure.
And she's recalling the fact that her mom, again, like mom lost life of her, like the fruit lost its juice, like it's lost its freshness because she felt her face drawn, puckered. Think about her mom, you know, two born dead kids. One died the first year, another one run under like a dried yellow apple. No, she was only 34 years old, 34 years old. She was old though. Like she's unraveling as she's like collapsed here at the top of the stairs. But Madame Zolita said, like, I think this is important. I talk about existentialism with my students a lot because you have to understand that and like the basics of, like, I teach in a Catholic school, so it helps. But like belief and action, like talking about the Catholic belief that action follows being, you could believe whatever you want to believe. I'll hold something behind my back. If you believe it's in my right hand, you have the right to believe that. If you believe it's in my left hand, you have the right to believe that too. You can believe it's in neither hand or that I'm holding it somehow simultaneously in both hands. But in the end, like the action follows being. I'm going to show you my hands and one of them will either have or not have something in it. You can say I am or am not pregnant. That doesn't change the fact that the science inside of you is changing.
Yeah. And I was wondering when you mentioned like she starts kind of rambling, like you said, and she's trying to justify it. She talks about like two born dead, one died in the first year, dried yellow apple. And she was only 34 years old. She was old. And I was part of that. It's almost like I felt like it shifted from her mom to her. And instead of 34, yeah, not being any age at all, it became an age when she was starting to come to grips with, yes, I am with child. I am old, you know, she has now equated that. And the, she is ambiguous, I think, for a reason. Like, I think between that, it went from talking about her mother to her at the end of that.
Yeah. And there's like four female voices here. There's her mom's voice. There's Ruby's voice. There's Madame Zolita's voice. And then there's our narrator author, Flannery O'Connor's voice. You know, that next sentence, Madame Zolita said it would end in no drying up. That's not what Madame Zolita said. That's what somebody else said, sort of mixed in with. And it's like, all these faces are blurring together in a question of womanhood, a question of fertility, a question of life, a question of death. And to be prepared for that or not be prepared for that, here we go. So she's looking around, she's kind of freaking out. We near the end of the story, she calms herself. No, it's just a stroke of, like, again, if this is a baby kicking or, you know, like something about just a nausea thing, like it'll pass. She settles herself, felt better, felt herself after a minute, getting almost as calm. I thought she just got upset too easy. Heck, it was just gas. Madame Zolita hadn't been wrong about anything. She knew more than, and just like that, we have a surprise show up at the end of this story. Do you kind of want to pre-cap or recap how the story pulls together this missing character who we kind of saw a hint of earlier?
Yeah, so in the beginning of the story, she kind of tried to take a quick break on the steps before she tackled them fully. And so a six-year-old young boy who lives in the apartment complex named Hartley Gilfeet, he left one of his toy pistols, and she sure enough, sat on the toy pistol. And I believe you and I had a good chuckle at about the innuendo that was implied and run with Laverne ran with it quite a bit. I think we were very professional and Laverne really took it to a new place.
I want to have her on the podcast, by the way.
Yes, Laverne would be a fantastic guest.
I'm in. All right, done. I interrupted you with a crude joke from Laverne. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. But so she and one interesting thing, I think she still has the pistol. Does she?
Yeah, she does.
Yeah. So she still has Hartley Gilfeet's pistol. And sure enough, we get a return. I guess not so much a return, but a callback. And Hartley actually appears. And it helped me too. The scene helped me picture it better because we got these like kind of roundabout staircases that are kind of rounding in on the hallways. And so I could picture Hartley running up these stairs and he has two pistols in his hands and he is just running up the staircase and kind of passing by all these characters that we met. So passes by Mr. Jerger who tries to snag him.
Yep. And he says, "Let go, you old goat teacher." I just love it. Like, we have privately low-key been told he kind of looks like a goat,
yep.
But like the narrator is like, you know, being kind, saying it like, but don't tell him. You know, the six-year-old kid, he's like, "Hey, let go, you old goat teacher." No, I mean, like, doesn't even filter it, just says what he wants to say.
Yeah.
And then he comes charging Chipmunk Face, crashes into this woman, and rocketed through her head, smaller and smaller, into a whirl of dark. So clearly there's some metaphorical stuff being played with there as this kid's really just racing up, right? You know, up, up, up he goes, grabbing his pop guns as he's running. She opens her eyes, gazes into the dark hole down at the very bottom where she had started up so long ago. "Good fortune," she said in a hollow voice that echoed through the levels of the cavern. "Baby." "Good fortune, baby," the three echoes leered. Then she recognized that feeling again, a little roll. It was as if it was not in her stomach. It was as if it were out nowhere in nothing, out nowhere resting and waiting with plenty of time. John, what do you think?
So just a couple things here. One line I underlined just because it goes back to that journey. She opened her eyes and gazed down in the dark hole, down to the very bottom where she had started up so long ago. And the choice of so long ago, it wasn't long ago. Like if you think back, like she had a short little interaction about Ponce de Leon's birthday. She hung out with Laverne and got mad at her. But if you really clock mm-hmm. this story of how long it took her to get up the stairs, like she had to pause and she was getting winded, you know, from various mm-hmm. factors. But the fact that she calls it where she had started up so long ago, I think right there, like Flannery's just overtly telling you she's gone through a little transformation on this journey and she is now kind of seeing that she's in a place where maybe she's a little bit more receptive to where she is in her life. And 34 maybe isn't just no age at all anymore. Being with child isn't any place at all. So that line just stood out to me because I, when I read it, I'm like, okay, in a literal sense, no, it's so long. She's looking back like,
minutes, right?
Oh, I was so young at the start of, you know, when I was at the bottom of the stairs, you know, 10 minutes ago or what have you. So it definitely shows like she is having that kind of Catholic reflective moment of the ordinary became extraordinary for her in just this waltz up the stairs and where she is for sure.
And I think in this moment, like in some ways she's a better, I don't know better, but like, let's say better, a better character here because there's an acceptance of what is about to happen. That denial in this moment is gone because it's being shouted back at her. Good fortune. Baby. It's like, you know, like there's your sign, right? And the story ends with like, and it's got plenty of time. That recalls again that story about before her brother was born, he was waiting, quote, nowhere in nothing, out nowhere, resting and waiting with plenty of time. Like, it's the South again. It's the history repeating. It's the things that are rising from your past and the things that you refuse to accept. In this moment, there's like maybe a hint that there's an acceptance there or just like almost like her guard is down and she's more vulnerable and maybe more, I don't know. There's a chance for that door being open just a little bit that there's a possibility for change in the character.
Yeah. And I do love the callback because she had that feeling that, you know, twice before she brings up that Rufus, it was like he was plotting to suck the life out of his mother. And here it seems like she's in a good place. You know, She seems contented, and she says it's with plenty of time that if that there is something waiting off in the void to enter my life, you know, she doesn't, she is not talking those same negative connotations like she has been before. You know, she says it's plenty of time, and I think plenty of time is a good thing. She's often used as a barometer, life and aging and time, and she says still plenty of time, whereas she called herself old a second ago. You know, she was old. Yeah. And so now that she's saying like, there's plenty of time, if I'm with child and I have this child and it comes, you know, I feel like there's plenty of time for that too. You know, she won't feel like she's the yellowed, dried up old apple of Pittman.
Right.
You know, apple pit too. I didn't even think of that, but.
Oh, look at that. Yeah. Now I want to go back and look at fruit.
Darn it.
But we'll call that a day for this time through. So we wanted to, first of all, say thanks, John, for coming on the podcast.
Yeah.
We really appreciate you having here today for sure.
Yeah.
Are you on the Twitter machine that people can get a hold of you? And
I absolutely am. Yeah. It's at Jonathan Spike. And I think you put it well before, John. It is just how it spells. Did I say smells or spells? It is just how it sounds. I botched the whole thing. Can we start over from one?
Yeah. You know? From minute one of the whole podcast.
Yeah. Everybody back to one. We'll take it from the top. It's exactly how it's spelled. You didn't say smelled or anything like that. It's exactly how it's spelled. So yep. At Jonathan Spike.
Fantastic. Yeah, please feel free to message John. Please feel free to message me. I'm on Twitter at MeehanEDU. I would gladly talk about this, any other literature, any other short stories. And if you'd like to be a guest on the podcast, message us. We'd love to have it. In the meantime, if you can like or comment, leave a rating, that helps people find it on your favorite podcasting app. In the meantime, we want to say thank you, stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll see you next time back here. Thanks again.